Well, no one knows that better than our next guest. Dr. Michael Mann has been in the forefront of researching our changing climate and weather. He is the Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State, also Director of the Earth System Science Center there, and author of the highly acclaimed and enlightening book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. I could go on with Michael Mann's credentials, but we only have him for 15 minutes, so I'm going to jump right in. Hey, Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Betsy. It's great to be with you.
I hope I can call you Mike, but we're on an email circle here, and I feel familiarity that I hope is...
Absolutely.
Okay, but you are our hero. You are our brave hero. You are...
Thank you.
You have been under fire, and we want to talk to you about a couple of really important things. So thanks so much for taking time for us. I know how busy you are. Last week you were in Iceland. You were just meeting with students. I don't even know how you keep up. But let me ask you one question. What do you do about the carbon offsets for all your travels, since we've just recently heard from another scientist who's given up flying? And I'm sure you've given a lot to this. Yes.
Yeah, it's certainly a quandary that we face. Those of us who do a fair amount of travel, for professional reasons, because we're sort of trying to get out there and talk about this issue, and sometimes that entails, going to conferences in distant locations, and the carbon emissions do start to add up, and so you can buy offsets. United Airlines, for example, makes it easy to do that. There's some question about, how verifiable these offsets are at present. In the end, I suppose the only real justification is that you sort of have to work within the system that exists. We would like to be in a place where we can meet our, energy needs entirely from non-carbon-based sources of energy. We're not there yet, and that means that, if you are involved in public outreach and that entails traveling to conferences and giving, lectures in various locations, you sort of have to deal with that for the time being. That, hopefully the, awareness that those of us who are out there talking about this issue are creating more than offsets our own personal carbon emissions. I, do everything in my personal life to minimize my carbon emissions as far as, the car we drive, fuel-efficient vehicles. We get our energy from wind, which is a luxury we have here in central Pennsylvania. We can opt to pay a little more and get all of our power from wind energy. So we do that. And we use recyclable shopping bags and do all those other, things, that low-hanging fruit, those sort of no-regrets activities that we can undertake that are good for us, that save us money, they're good for our health, and they, they hold down our carbon emissions. But ultimately, as we all know, voluntary measures aren't going to get us to where we need to go. We need to find a way to price carbon. We need to make sure that we level the energy, industry playing field, so that renewable energy can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy, which means internalizing in the economic decision-making the damages that are being done by carbon emissions.
Mm. And before I ask you about the divest movement and the carbon tax movement, the Citizens Climate Lobby and their great efforts, let's just back up a couple weeks and tell us what we should know as far as takeaways from the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC report.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was asked by one journalist, if I was going to, provide a headline to summarize the most recent IPCC report, what would it be? And what I said was very simple. The globe is warming, climate is changing, it's due to us, and it represents a threat if we don't do something about it. That's the clear, it's the unambiguous message of the latest report, which ratchets up the level of confidence that the global community of climate scientists has now in attributing the warming we've seen already to anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, human greenhouse gas emissions. The IPCC raised their level of confidence from very likely to extremely likely, which is about as strong a statement as you'll ever see thousands of scientists around the world reach a consensus, extremely likely that most, if not all, of the warming that we have seen over the past half century is due to greenhouse gas emissions. And moreover, for the first time, they related that warming confidently to impacts that we are already seeing: rising sea level, melting ice, more extreme weather of various sorts. We can now attribute that confidently to the warming of the planet and the change in climate that we are causing by, you know, burning fossil fuels and emitting carbon into the atmosphere. The science on that matter is settled. There's no legitimate debate anymore about whether we are warming the planet, changing the climate, and if we continue to do so, if we continue to follow business as usual with our fossil fuel emissions, we will see, you know, dangerous and potentially irreversible climate change impacts in the future.
And as compelling as this conservative consensus document is, the IPCC report, you know, it wasn't much different, I don't think, you know, 5 years ago when it came out. And while it did wake up a lot of people, certainly not enough to, you know, combat the deniosphere, the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And but yet, with the extreme weather events we've had in this country, so damaging, so destructive, don't need to list them all, more Americans are starting to connect the green dots. Do you think in the wake of Superstorm Sandy and, you know, flooding and fires and droughts, this report will, you know, sort of help make whoever might have been on the fence for whatever reason really get concerned? And if so, then what do we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, you allude to the fact, and it's absolutely true, that we actually knew enough nearly two decades ago to act on this problem. Back when the second assessment report of the IPCC was released in 1995, the scientists had already concluded at that point that there was a detectable UN influence on our climate. We've known that for nearly two decades now, and we still haven't done something about it. And, you know, it's sort of like the veritable tip of the iceberg. You know, once you come up close, and you know, once you nearly collide with the tip of the iceberg, it's way too late, because you're going to hit that 90% of the iceberg that you didn't see, which lies underneath the surface of the water. And that's sort of what is happening here. By the time the impacts of climate change become clear in terms of our day-to-day weather events, and that's clearly the case now. Here in the U.S., we had the hottest summer ever last year. As you alluded to, we've seen unprecedented heat and drought and wildfire and melting ice and superstorms with extremely unusual characteristics, some of which were likely impacted by climate change. The recent flooding event in Boulder, Colorado, many climate scientists believe had a clear climate change fingerprint on it. So, you know, by the time you're seeing climate change express itself so clearly in the day-to-day weather, it's already too late to mitigate some of the damage that's been done, and that's sort of where we are. On the other hand, it's not too late to turn our emissions around, to bring our emissions to a peak, our carbon emissions within the next few years, ramp them down in the decades ahead, so that we avoid, you know, the worst possible consequences of climate change, what we might truly term dangerous and irreversible changes in our climate. We're close to committing to those changes, but we think we still have time. So there's no cause for despair, but there is a greater urgency now than there has ever been in terms of, you know, the need to confront this problem head on.
Maybe you could help me with my recent despair in watching what's going on or what's not happening in Congress, what our representatives are not able to agree on. It doesn't bode well for those of us who are hoping the climate might be getting more receptive to carbon tax.
Yeah.
But how does this bode for that? I mean, I just am so discouraged because, you know, the last thing we need is bickering children.
Right. Well, and that's clearly what we've seen over the last week. And, you know, the connection is far more real than most people realize, because there was a wonderful article in, I think it was the New York Times the other day, describing how it was various organizations and front groups funded by the Koch brothers of Koch Industries, KOCH, that have been planning the government shutdown for, you know, more than a year now. They had been planning this, and this, what we're seeing play out today, you know, the government shutdown is the result of a well-coordinated and well-planned campaign by, you know, far right-wing ideologues like the Koch brothers, who fund the Tea Party, who fund the various front groups that have been behind the effort to discredit the science of climate change. It's the same folks, the Koch brothers, who have been funding the disinformation campaign, the climate change disinformation campaign. So most Americans don't realize it, but there is a very real direct connection between the forces that are behind the dysfunction of our politics today, as is playing out, you know, day by day now with the government shutdown, and those same forces that are looking to derail that necessary discussion of how to deal with our, you know, ongoing carbon emissions and the climate change problem that they are causing. So these same individuals are attempting to poison that discussion by pouring tens of millions of dollars into front groups like, you know, so-called Americans for Prosperity and many others, whose sole purpose is, again, to derail any meaningful progress in dealing with issues like climate change. Fortunately, you know, the bad news is that they now have control of our House of Representatives, and without significant change in the composition of our House of Representatives, there's no hope for seeing, you know, a meaningful climate bill pass Congress. That having been said, the executive branch, you know, the Obama administration is taking executive actions to deal with this problem, for example, through the recent new revised standards for the EPA in the allowable carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. And so, you know, the administration is doing what they can to try to do something about the problem. We have an intransigence right now in our Congress, and the only real solution there is you know, political change, is for people to vote into Congress, individuals, you know, politicians who are going to represent their interests, the interests of us and our children and our grandchildren who are going to inherit the problem that we're creating, rather than the narrow special interests like the fossil fuel front groups and the Koch brothers who are funding their campaigns.
And where will they be when our children are growing up into this? You know, I know you've got to go, but I've just got to ask you, Mike, what's the latest with your lawsuit?
You know what? The lawsuit is something I'm not talking about because it is a pending legal matter. You know, you can find some discussions of it online. There was a good article today in the Washington Post, and there was another piece that ran in the Allentown morning news. Morning call, rather. So folks can find some discussion about that online. But I'll resist talking about that. Specifically, I'd be happy to talk about, you know, I've got a few minutes here. I'd happy to talk about some other, you know, issues.
Great.
Related to the larger, you know, disinformation campaign, the attacks.
Great. I just want to bring in, thanks so much for staying with us a few more minutes. D.R. Tucker has been out at a protest in Boston, and I want him to bring him into the conversation as I ask you about the divestiture movement that Bill McKibben has been spearheading. Do you think that is part of what we need to derail the undue influence of the Koch industries, oil industries, fossil fuel industry?
Sure. Hey, DR. Good to be with you, too. So, you know, I think Bill McKibben, you know, has really done a remarkable job of, you know, creating a mass movement and really drawing upon, you know, the energy and enthusiasm of younger people, which is something that I encounter. One of the things that gives me optimism that we're going to confront this problem before it's too late is, you know, the enthusiasm and, you know, and the energy that I encounter among, you know, younger folks, college-age students, high school students today. When I go out, you know, and I lecture about this issue, and I speak to church groups and high school audiences and college and university towns, I think the younger generation gets it. They understand that, you know, there's a legacy that we are leaving. And, you know, the decisions we are making today with our carbon emissions and the climate change it's creating is going to leave a lasting legacy of decades and even centuries of damage if we don't do something about it now. And so with this divestiture movement, you know, Bill McKibben, you know, I think has done, an admirable job in drawing upon that enthusiasm and organizing, you know, younger folks to be active in, you know, in the discussion that's going to, you know, determine their future, and putting pressure on institutions to make the right decisions, to make the decisions that, you know, will help preserve our planet rather than simply increase the corporate profits of, you know, of fossil fuel interests. I think that is an effective way of leveraging pressure on some of those institutions, on fossil fuel corporations, on the people, you know, their board members and their stockholders. You know, this is a democratic country, and even, you know, the corporations, you know, there's a democratic process there. They have to, you know, do the will of their stockholders. And one could very easily make the argument that that some fossil fuel interests are not acting in a way that is beneficial to their stockholders because they're, you know, making decisions that are impacting the planet that we all live on and that we all rely upon and that our children and grandchildren are going to inherit. So drawing on that energy, you know, especially of the youth, I think is a great way to try to move the needle a bit on this issue. Obviously, that alone isn't going to solve the problem as long as we have policymakers who are essentially just acting as, you know, as paid advocates for the fossil fuel industry. We're not going to see, you know, a climate bill pass our Congress. So the other thing that young folks and old folks, older folks alike have to engage in is, you know, putting pressure on our policymakers at the voting booth by writing letters to the editor of your local newspaper, writing op-eds, talking with your neighbors, your friends, your family, doing everything you can to put pressure on our policymakers and, again, electing policymakers who will do, you know, who will represent the interests of the people of this country rather, again, than the narrow interests of the fossil fuel corporations that are funding their campaigns. That's ultimately the only way we're going to see true change is by electing enlightened policymakers to our Congress and to local offices. And that's going to take a lot of hard work as well. And that's something that college students and younger folks can really, you know, can be actively involved in to change the situation.
Young people like D.R. Tucker, who was out protesting a local broadcast station in Boston today.
I want young to bring at heart, him in any case, yes.
He's young. We know he's young because he doesn't sleep. He's 24 hours a day, or at least 20, sending us everything on the net related to climate change. So what happened out there today, D.R.? Are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. This has been an amazing event of, let's say, in excess of 100 people showing up. A great job organized by the great Brad Johnson, Emily Sufferd from Forecast Facts. It's called the Rally for a Coke-Free WGBH. WGBH is the PBS affiliate in Boston where David Koch is a member of the Board of Trustees. We presented, in my opinion, a very compelling case that WGBH ought to sort of divest itself of David Koch's involvement. We had some great speakers, including the Reverend Fred Small and Vanessa Rule of 350 Massachusetts, a couple of other speakers from 350 Massachusetts as well, some alumni from Suffolk University, Northeastern University. Right now, Brad and Emily have gone into the GBH building where they will present 119,000 signatures that they've received calling on WGBH to, again, sever ties with David Koch from the board of directors of their station. So So this has been an amazing rally. There will be some coverage of this online, and already there's some postings on Twitter about it. But it has been just an extraordinary event. I so wish that that you and Professor Mann were here, because it was just an amazing and an electrifying event today.
Oh. That's great news, and we needed that, right, Mike, about now?
Yeah, you know, it's good news is always helpful here, because, you know, like I said before, there are some reasons for optimism. As bad as, you know, as gloomy as things sometimes look, there's reason for optimism. We're starting to see a level of energy here and activism in terms of, you know, forcing the hand of our policymakers to do what's right that, you know, that I haven't witnessed you know, before. And that makes me optimistic.
And while we're ending on a note involving the media, you know, both of you, that my pet peeve and passion for 15 years has been trying to get mainstream broadcast media to put on a dedicated show. It's only, you know, future of our, you know, habitable life and stable climate hanging in the balance that, you know, really talks about, you know, all these many, many challenges we face, how they're interconnected, how rapidly they're occurring, and most importantly, what we can do about it. And I think targeting the media is a really good idea. That's my two cents.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay, we just have 1 minute. I just have to ask you, Mike, the latest news just today, there's never any shortage of developments, is the melting permafrost. The North Pole is melting under the homes of and streets of people, residents up there. Does this surprise you or not?
Well, no, it doesn't surprise me. Unfortunately, you know, the Arctic is sort of, you know, running ahead of schedule. If we want to see a vision of what climate change poses for us in the decades ahead, we need only look at the Arctic, where they are seeing unprecedented changes, declines in the amount of sea ice, the melting of permafrost that are, you know, fundamentally unlike anything human beings have seen there before. And it's a non-analog world. There was a paper that just came out in the journal Nature today looking forward and assessing when it is that we are going to encounter states of our climate and weather that have no analog in the past, as far back as we can go. And they argue that, you know, in some regions, we're already, you know, we're already there. And, you know, that's a problem. It means that we've already gone past, you know, the point where climate change is becoming dangerous. We need to hold the warming of the planet below 2 degrees Celsius, which we can still do if we are to avert, you know, the most catastrophic consequences. But we're already seeing, you know, potentially catastrophic climate change play out in some regions like the Arctic.
And that's why we need more programming that connects the dots faster, you know, to a wider group of Americans so we can find out what we can do about it. I think there's really very little question that we're, you know, in the midst of an emerging emergency and crisis here. So thank you so much, Dr. Michael Mann, professor of meteorology at Penn State, author of the fabulous book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, for all you do, continue to do, being brave, outspoken, and somehow all over the place, and doing it in a sustainable manner. I mean, just where I started out about the carbon offsets, I know way was I giving you a hard time. In fact, what I say when people used to criticize Al Gore for flying around, I'd say, but look what he's doing when he lands. Look at the good he's doing and spreading the message. You know, 98% of people are flying around and not doing any good for the climate.
Well, thanks.
You know, going
and
about their business,
always,
or personal lives.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope to do so again soon.
We'd love to have you anytime. And D.R. Tucker, thanks for being our man on the street today, reporting
thanks.
Live from that protest in Boston, just topping off what's been a great hour. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can go to thegreenfront.com or prn.fm to listen to the entire program. And you can also listen to our show now, my blog expert Philippe Boucher tells me, on your iPhone or iPad. So we're trying to make it easier for you to catch The Green Front. Please tell your friends and family about this best-kept secret on the Internet. On PRN, we cover the breaking news on the Green Front Lines every week, as we're doing today. Have a great green week. In the meantime, well, stay cool, stay warm, depending on what weather extreme is in your neck of the woods. Take care.